Hi, this is Dr. Tony DiGiacomo, founder of Novella Prep. With me today is Dr. Elise Capella from New York University. Hello.
Hi.
Thanks for joining us today. I'd like to talk a little bit about how you came into the field of education.
My parents were the first in their families to go all the way with their education. And my father's father, my grandfather, who immigrated from a town outside Naples, Italy, when he was a young person, always emphasized to his son, my father, that education was the most important thing to spend his time and his money on. And I think that was inculcated in me from a very young age. I saw education as a space that could provide pathways to unexpected and meaningful careers. But I also, interestingly, saw that schools, traditional education settings, were not always serving all kids in the same way. And I, from high school through college and into my early years outside of college, recognized the importance not only of working in more traditional education settings, but also thinking about education in innovative ways, thinking about after school spaces, educational television. My first job out of college was working for the company that makes Sesame Street on a literacy show for 8 to 10 year olds called Ghostwriter. But I also was an assistant teacher in a fourth grade classroom, and I volunteered in schools and worked with community organizations. So I thought about education in a very expansive and inclusive way. And that's how I got to where I am today.
Thank you. No, I can relate very much. I'm a third generation educator myself. And I always saw early that another way of looking at our systems of education, if we think of the US as 50 systems of education, that there are many ways to participate and engage in education. And sometimes approaching it from new angles can lead you in new pathways towards solutions that might not have otherwise emerged. Which brings me to a question about your role at New York University. If you could explain a little bit about that, please.
I wear two hats. I am Vice Dean for Research at NYU's Steinhardt School of Culture, Education, and Human Development. And I am also a professor of applied psychology. That means that I teach, I do research, and then I oversee and support the research across our 300 faculty, 11 departments, 8 research centers. It's very interdisciplinary work. It's in education. It's also in health and human development. It's in the arts, media, culture, and communication. And what I'm very proud of in terms of the work that our faculty and our students do and our staff support is that it's both deeply disciplinary in terms of people know their area well, and it is at intersections. So people work together across these so-called divides, academic divides, and across systems, education, mental health, juvenile justice, social welfare, to try to make a difference in both advancing science and also making a difference in the lives of children, families, and communities.
As somebody who's been a teacher and now also conducts research, how important do you see research as a contributor to the field of education itself?
Incredibly important. We as researchers, as colleges and universities have, I see, a duty to contribute to both scientific knowledge, but also to relevant, applicable scientific knowledge so that it can be used to solve urgent problems in the field of education. I argue for partnered work where researchers are learning from and contributing to partner organizations that can be schools and school districts, that also can be nonprofit organizations, NGOs for people doing global work in education. It can be public-private partnerships because university researchers have a set of expertise to bring, and it's not complete. To make complete, smart, holistic studies that are relevant and responsive and rigorous, we need to partner. And so bringing those resources, the expertise from universities, the infrastructure from universities to organizations, having those organizations bring their displaced evidence and expertise to the universities, that intersection, that partnership is most fruitful.
So by bringing research to practice, there's an opportunity to learn and continue growing, and there's a nice feedback loop that can happen there, of course. And also, I would imagine involving parents at some point in this process would be helpful, not only to researchers and practitioners, but also to the parents themselves. How might you advise a parent looking to stay on top of trends that can be helpful for their little ones? Maybe they're not necessarily interested in trends in research per se, as much as getting information to help raise healthy children. How can a parent follow some of the research coming out of Steinhardt?
Parents are critically important to researchers in so many ways. I'm a parent myself. I work really collaboratively with parents and families in my own work. So not only is their voice important to guiding research questions, helping to shape the areas of focus for researchers, but parents also should have access and benefit from the research that's happening. So I would advise families, that could be parents or grandparents or aunts or uncles or just caregivers, anyone who is interested in learning about research, about young people, to go to NYU Steinhardt and other schools of education and look up their research centers. We have research centers that are focused on equity and excellence in education. They have very accessible materials. They can connect parents to those materials that are written, sometimes they're oral, as well as to contact information. I receive emails from families and I happily respond to try to create connections and to try to direct folks toward resources that I think might help them.
Thank you. Yes. And one of the things that I found was how much content was accessible to non-researchers. You don't need to have a PhD to read a lot of the publications or a lot of the summaries of research that can be very helpful for today's parent or caregiver. And that brings me to looking at some of the emerging trends as we emerge from the way in which COVID shaped students to have to go online and then back in school. And there's been a change in student attitudes and dispositions. We see, at least in our practice at Novella Prep, we've seen an increase in student stress and anxiety, emerging habits that are not always optimal for learning. I'd be curious to understand what kinds of trends you and your team has seen as a result of the pandemic.
You named several of them. I'll add to that some lags in math achievement more than reading, and some of the increased symptoms of anxiety and depression, experiences of trauma. Of course, these challenges have been highest among the least advantaged groups of students, and that's not surprising given the layers of structural inequities in our systems and in our communities. I think I would say, though, and I'd love to shift the frame a little bit to think about also the remarkable resilience that we've seen in young people and families and in teachers. And we need to not discount the many challenges that they faced and the ongoing nature of those challenges, but also accompany our understanding of those challenges with an equal understanding of the incredible sort of creativity and resourcefulness and strength that we've seen in our communities. Those stories need to be told as well.
That's very true. It's not simply a binary concept of a negative thing happened and or is happening and now we're recovering from it, but focusing more on growth and how experiences shape us and how we process these things. What kinds of research are you exploring as a result of some of these emerging trends that we see? Has any of this shifting caused a new direction or rethinking about education or education research?
In my own research, I have been working in the last few years, again, in partnership with school districts and policy organizations and schools and families and teachers themselves to do a better job of bridging social, emotional, and academic learning and centering equity and inclusion in the practices that are happening. So that's something that I've always thought about and focused on, but I'm doubling down in that space, given some of what we just discussed, some of the challenges that our schools and families and students and teachers are facing. I can give an example of a partnership that is ongoing between NYU's Steinhardt School and the Institute of Human Development and Social Change, and then the New York City schools, their specialized programs. We are developing together and studying and then anticipate scaling a program called the PATH program, which is an inclusion model for students with or at risk for emotional disabilities. And it is designed to provide students who are in need of additional emotional and behavioral and social support a chance to remain in their community schools with their peers. It uses culturally responsive, trauma-informed and strengths-based lenses and practices. It focuses on high academic expectation integrated with deeply and intensively supported social emotional skills and family engagement components. So this kind of program is not something that is newly needed, but the need has been exacerbated by COVID. And so we're really excited to have this partnership and to be working really closely with the schools and the district in developing this work.
I would agree. And the benefits of this growth, if we think about, so why do you need to do this? I mean, some of those constructs you just mentioned, it's quite obvious. We want a student to have personal agency, to be resilient, to be able to get along nice with others. But as we think about why it's so important, can we look at it from the perspective of this idea, if you're a parent raising a healthy child who has the ability to understand themselves and to manifest a future they want to, perhaps imagining a future based on some of their natural talents and some of the skills they build over time, and not having barriers put in front of them that perhaps they could have avoided in the first place, or better, being able to just propel themselves forward and make the most of the environment in which they live? Could that be one way of looking at some of the benefits of this besides the obvious implied benefits of them? Do we even have to look at it from a benefits perspective?
I agree. I think what you're saying, if I'm understanding your question correctly, is that some of this is about helping young people navigate the environments that are in front of them and
yes,
to be able to succeed even in tough environments. I think that is true. I also think we have a responsibility as leaders in education, as people who care about education, as parents who have a voice in education, to push for environments that are supportive and promotive of young people across all the different strengths and all the different kinds of needs that young people have. So I think it's a both and.
I would agree. Speaking of this idea of raising healthy children from the perspective of school systems and education as a field, how can we balance maintaining accountability and routines and the notion of hoping for growth while balancing social emotional learning and the cognizance that students are under stress and varying kinds of stress and types of stress that perhaps we as parents did not experience in the way in which they are? And are these two things antithetical?
No, they're not antithetical. We know from decades of research that kids need structure and routine and high expectations accompanied by warm, compassionate connection and appropriate high-quality scaffolding. Those things must go hand in hand. I would argue that our young people certainly are facing challenges that we have not necessarily faced ourselves. And that is okay. What we need to do as parents and as teachers is to continue to learn about our kids, continue to be open to their growth and development. And so keeping open communication with our kids, with our students, trust and honesty, making mistakes, recognizing those mistakes, learning from those mistakes are all part of the puzzle here. And this idea that accountability cannot be maintained or high expectations should not be held because there are challenges is absolutely the wrong way to think. The right way to think is to have flexibility and openness and processes through which to understand when we need to adapt and change and be flexible, but always, always to have the highest of expectations and accompany those with the highest level of supports.
I like the way you frame that. In our experience at Novella Prep, we've seen many students who are, whether they're neurodivergent or just simply underperforming, perhaps not as organized as they could be, And even among the higher achieving students in more rigorous courses, we see that, at least through the lens of the student and the family, schools really not wanting to be seen as pushing the student toward aiming for higher grades. There isn't this notion of growth quarter over quarter of you did this, you know, you got an 89 last quarter. How might we study different to get a 90 or 91 this quarter? And instead of there being just an implied expectation of growth, a teaching of how to grow, a teaching of what are the reasons you are where you are, and not seeing grades as judgment, but grades as data, a way of navigating forward. It's information. And then how do we use this information? And we see that there seems to be this pulling back from encouraging growth because it's seen as causing stress. In parents too, this tension between wanting to maintain a relationship as the child gets older and older and becomes increasingly independent, the tension around digital devices and their life, and then trying to increase accountability at the same time, causing additional tension. So what ends up happening, we see over and over again, are the schools not advocating or pushing for growth. And we see parents being reluctant to want to push because they're worried about mental well-being. When in fact, at least in our practice, by teaching study skills and executive functioning, stress tends to come from disorganization. It tends to come from routines that are not optimal, perhaps not understanding how to leverage asynchronous content or engaging in more active study skills, or not understanding what they don't understand and how to do anything about it. So for us, it seems that it's more of a teaching them toward growth opportunity that exists, as opposed to an implicit expectation of high achievement without that support. And it seems what you've been talking about today and in some of this research is it's both at the same time, providing the right environment and the right support and maintaining those high expectations. Would that be a fair way of summarizing it?
Absolutely. I would add a couple of things to your really lovely set of points. One is that there's different kinds of data to bring to bear on this. So you mentioned grades, and that's one source of data. But other sources of data are the students themselves, their own self-reported engagement and goals and motivations. I think that's an important source of data to consider. The grades are an amalgam of a variety of things, including behaviors and mastery of content and quality of homework and ability to attend. But I think considering the other source of data from students, from families, from quality of a particular kind of work. It may not be quality of all of the work, but particular kind of work that the student is motivated to do. So considering all of that data, I think, is helpful. I also would say that when we push students, I'm going to put that in air quotes, it is best when that's happening together, right? Where it's more of a motivational space that the child is in, the parent is in, the teacher is in, the support providers like you are in, so that together you're going toward a shared goal. And identifying that shared goal, working together to meet that shared goal, identify what it would look like to get there, how to get there, to do some course corrections along the way if you're not getting there, so that it becomes something that is collective, rather than unidirectional in one way or another. And I think that will benefit every person who's in that collective, including the student.
That makes a lot of sense, especially as students get older and we enter high school and this concept of starting to think about tertiary education and selectivity of school and program fit. There ends up being this notion of college itself being a destination, a final destination, when in fact it's really another significant stop along your journey, another significant location along your journey, and that your future is not defined by specifically only where you're going to college, but it's really the aspiration around the skills you're looking to acquire as you come to understand yourself and you think about the kinds of, even if we look at it from a vocational perspective, what you wish to do with yourself. And what I found with the way in which you're describing the approach to education, it leads to an understanding of self, which inherently leads to more likely an understanding of how you fit into the world and or how you'd like to reshape it. So the pursuit of college ends up being the pursuit of a place that can help continue your growth as a learner in an environment that you would more implicitly understand that you want, as opposed to only looking at it from the simple perspective of selectivity and or program fit.
I love that you mentioned not only what you want to gain from the environment, but how you also could shape the environments in the future, how you want to shape the world in the future. And I think we often underestimate the incredible resource that is our youth, our young people who are bringing the kind of energy and new ideas and innovative thinking that only young people can bring. And so they're bringing themselves to a college that is going to fit them, where they want to go, what their strengths are, where they want to get vocationally in the future, how they want to shape the world. But they are also going to shape that space because they are coming into it with their exciting, new, and important ideas. And as a college professor, I love that. I love that I learn as much from my students as they learn from me and that we grow together. So I would say to young people and to parents, yes, this college process is really intense and it often feels like a stepping stone, and it's about potentially about prestige or what other people think, but it really is your own student and who they are and who they want to be and how they want to shape the world.
What a wonderful way to end our conversation for today. So I'd like to thank Dr. Elise Capella from New York University for speaking with us today and sharing your stories.
Thank you so much for your time.
That's all for this episode of A Novel Take. Thanks for listening. Remember to subscribe for more discussions on the latest education headlines, key topics, and expert interviews. As always, you can learn more about us at novellaprep.com and find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at novellaprep. I'm Dr. Tony DiGiacomo. Bye for now.